Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Ben Radford and Dr. Karen Stolzno, each week we talk about monsters, the evidence for them, the science behind them, and their impact on society. This week we have an interview with author Stephen Asma about his new book titled On Monsters. If you love monsters and are interested in their impact on Western culture, you'll enjoy this book. It has great illustrations and lots of interesting details. You'll learn more about it in our interview. Links to the book will be in the show notes. Let's get started.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Today we're going to be talking about On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears by Stephen T. Asma. This is a really nice book, Steve. I really like this book. It's really beautiful. You called it a sort of a survey of Western monsters, and boy, you cover a lot of material. What led you to want to write such a comprehensive survey of monsters?
It's one of those things where once you get going, you can't stop. I think, was drawn to some of this material because I had written a book on the development of natural history museums called Stuffed Animals and Pickled Heads, and that had gotten me interested in sort of these teratology specimens and freaks and this sort of underbelly of natural history. That's really sort of from the late Renaissance all the way up through sort of the P.T. Barnum era. And then I realized that, you know, because I have sort of training in philosophy, I thought, you know, Aristotle has things to say about monsters too. And then there's all this sort of medieval stuff on demons. And somehow one thing led to another. I thought there's kind of a series of threads that I could trace from the ancient world all the way up to the present. And that's basically how it got going.
And your background is in philosophy, right?
Yeah, that's my training.
It's, you know, it's one of those things where, yeah, when you go to a carnival and go see the freak shows and the pickled punks and all those sorts of things, the babies in the jars, you don't necessarily think of that as necessarily being in the realm of philosophy. But of course, in many ways it is, because, you know, the question becomes, you know, what is a monster and why are we attracted to them? And I'll just reinforce what Blake said. I mean, as someone who has had a similar interest in you know, freaks and monsters and things that go bump in the night and scare us, this is one of the best books on the subject I've read, and I have a shelf of them. So this is very good work here.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And I think Oxford did a good job with the design work too. You know, today in publishing, people are looking to cut corners, but they really, I think, crafted the book. They even like created new fonts to have like little monsters in the letters on some of the, you know, chapters.
Yeah, I saw that.
So they really did a nice job.
You did some of the illustrations yourself.
I started out as a illustrator and a painter when I was in college. And so I've always continued to do drawings. And, you know, one of the things about the history of monsters is that some of it is in the texts, you know, either in story or in the, you know, the theological writings of Augustine or what have you. But some of it really comes out of the pictorial traditions. So artists have for a long time been imagining and reimagining monsters. And so as somebody who draws, I thought, well, this is sort of a great opportunity for me to get to draw some of these things too. So that was a lot of fun.
The artwork's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, you did really great illustrations and in a lot of different styles. So some of the stuff looked like, you know, kind of pseudo woodcut, and some of it looked like really nice, careful graph illustrations. So,
and some of the stuff, for example, you drew the golem, and that reminded me immediately of Dungeons and Dragons Monster Manual that I used to play with. I'm like, hey, he did the art for D&D. That was awesome. So, well, let me ask you: are you in the first part of the book? You talk about sort of being phobic about lake monsters and murky water and spiders. Do you still have that, or did you sort of work out those demons through writing the book?
No, I still have some of those phobias about deep water. I think that stuff is like deep in the. It's not in the limbic brain. It's all the way back in the reptile brain. And no matter how much my neocortex learns about, you know, that the water's safe and that there's nothing to fear, and you know, I'm a skeptic too. I have sort of a skeptical nature. I can't convince my old brain to let go of some of these fears. So it's not like I won't get in the water or anything. It's just that when I go swimming in a lake or something, I'm imagining some Leviathan down below. And then I got to say, you know, scientists do dredge up some fairly weird stuff on a regular basis, and it reminds me, you know, that there's a lot more out there that we're unaware of. So I guess that keeps me on my toes.
Yeah, or off the lake bottom, right? So
yeah, right off the lake bottom. Anyway.
I thought that was interesting because you mentioned how that people with a phobia of snakes, even if the snake's been devenomized or defanged, still have that instinctive fear. And I mean, your book's not exactly on fear, it's on monsters, but you know, fear and monsters go hand in hand, I guess.
I suppose, you know, there's kind of a literature coming out of evolutionary psychology that says, that some of these phobias might be hardwired in the brain, like a module of some sort, where even if you do show somebody, you know, we've removed the venom or, you know, this is not a poisonous spider or whatever, that still the fear is quite intense. And so some of these folks in the evolutionary psychology tradition think, well, there's a good reason why that fear would be there, because, of course, it behooved our ancestors to stay away from these things because so you could pass on your gene line. And so this somehow got built up. Now, I'm not sure that's true, but I do think there's something to it. There's an interesting study that I think I'm trying to remember. I think it was Tim Flannery. I mentioned in the book, Tim Flannery, I think is his name. He was looking, why is spider phobia so universal? Because it seems to cross a lot of, you know, cultural barriers. And the argument is that, well, there should be some kind of spider perhaps in our African prehistory that perhaps may have been the prototype for this fear. And it turns out there are spiders that are extremely dangerous to babies in the sort of Serengeti and Savannah region. The argument is they were always there, and that they could have been the selective pressure for sort of this kind of phobia module in the brain. So that's one theory.
That's hard to falsify, but it does make sense.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at like I think I was reading recently about tobacco plants, or it might have been cotton, but I think it was tobacco, where that you can look and see that it can, based on an insect response, it can generate different chemical scents to attract predators for whatever is preying on it, right? And so it's easy to say, well,
right.
Okay, if it can generate six or seven chemicals or five chemicals, but it only has three predators, then there's probably two missing, two that have been extinct for some reason. But going for fears, it's harder to figure out what, you know, what from, you know, that seems like it's not necessarily a defensive mechanism, but it seems like it's an important thing to have for safety's sake. But it really, falsifying Evo Psych is really difficult, but it certainly is fascinating.
I agree.
Yeah.
No, I think a better theory might be that we have some of these affective systems like fear. And, you know, there's sort of interesting work being done by the affective neuroscientist named Jaak Panksepp, and he shows that the affective system is sort of in place, but it can be triggered by a variety of different environmental factors. So it's not that you have modules in the brain hardwired. That I think is probably not correct. But once you, there are sort of environmental triggers that are going to be sort of changeable or malleable depending on where you're born and where you grow up. And these get fed into the system, and then they sort of lock in as sort of cognitive defaults after a certain time, once, you know, plasticity of the brain sort of closes or something. So that's a different sort of theory to try to get some explanation of how some of these phobias get sort of burned in.
It is absolutely a fascinating book. And I wanted to say you surprised me because I've read so many books about monsters. It's rare that I pick up one and learn something completely new unless I go into, you know, at least in Western culture. I'm always learning stuff about Asian monsters and South American monsters. that I didn't know, just because I grew up reading more of, like, you know, Greek culture, you know, mythology and monster books from Western Europe. You were talking about the cynocephalous dog-headed men, and I didn't know that St. Christopher was supposedly one of these creatures.
Yeah, that's not well known in the West. Even if you're born and, even if you're raised Christian, I was raised as a Catholic, but Roman Catholicism, shares many of the same saints that the Eastern Orthodox, Russian and Greek Orthodox Church has, but the traditions are quite different. And in the Eastern Church, St. Christopher is a cynocephalus, and this is the dog-headed creatures that were believed to roam about in Lower Egypt, North Africa. Sometimes they were attributed to India, but they were like men in every other way, except they had dogs' heads and they couldn't speak. They would just bark at each other. And there's references to them all the way back in the ancient Greek Ctesias, and then up through the Romans, Pliny, and then into the medieval era. They were fascinated by it. So there's some passage apparently where Christopher, who they suggest was from this land of the dog heads, and it sort of gets translated as, you know, that he's a cynocephalus. So there's a pictorial tradition where he's actually represented as this dog-headed creature, and he converts to Christianity, and then the Holy Spirit gives him the power of human speech, but with this human speech, he's able to go out and convert others, and he sort of has superpowers and all the rest of it too.
So he would go out and convert others because of his miracle and because he's got the dog head.
Right. Huh. Yeah.
Would he, before he converted them, would he sniff their butts? I would assume so.
It's entirely possible. It's a good sign of being a barbarian.
Yeah, you mentioned the Hunterian Museum and its collection of deformed babies. And as you noted in the book, I mean, there are a couple other museums. I think that the Mutter Museum is probably the best known around here. What do you think that draws people to such things?
Yeah, there is this, there's this interesting continuity between, like, the unfortunate, you know, developmental cases where you have, like, conjoined twins and these teratology cases, and the chimeras of the ancient Greek tradition, for example, like, where you're, like you said, it's like a mix of, well, it's human but not quite human, or it's some combination of a human and another kind of creature. And I don't know, there's a philosopher, Noel Carroll, who argues that there's something attractive about cognitive mismatch like this, that the world is ordinarily organized for us, you know, in terms of these categories, you're human or you're not human. But whenever you have these boundary crossers, there's something sort of exciting about this and arousing. And I don't know what the sort of neurophysiology of it would be, but it does seem to be the case that we're both attracted and repulsed by things that don't fit in these categories. So in the book, I'm trying to give a lot of examples of these and try to suggest why this might be the case. And I do think there's something, there's also this sort of, this, how can I put it, like, there but for the grace of God go I, a feature of some of these museum specimens, like at the Hunterian. I remember there was this kid, it's in the Royal College of Surgeons, and I'm in there, and there's basically nobody in there. And this kid comes in with his mother, and the mother's showing the kid these sort of vitrines with these horrible, like, all the ways nature can go wrong. There's just, like, lots of different limbs on this thing and not enough limbs on another, and two heads here, and the kid is just grossing out and, oh, my God, and just thoroughly disgusted. And then the mother says, well, should we go? Is this disturbing? And he goes, no, let's stay. And, mm-hmm. there's something about this that we're all familiar with, I think. And monsters are a great, great sort of place where this happens.
When you were talking about, the ways in which we're attracted or interested and intrigued by things that are sort of half one way, half the other way. I mean, hermaphrodites would be a good example. And I guess you could make the argument that even evil people, serial killers and genocidal maniacs, we can sort of picture somebody, you know, killing their neighbor over, you know, some yard dispute or in a drunken rage. And we can certainly picture someone not doing that because that's our everyday life. But then when you have this sort of extreme, like, well, they're taking it far and above, and that sort of holds a certain fascination for people.
I think that's right. Yeah. Monsters, if you know, I try to look at what are some of the universals about monsters, because there's a lot of sort of particular differences. But one of the universals is the one you just hit on, I think, which is that they really do violate, you know, our normal rational processing of what's happening. And in the old days, the monsters were sort of natural history kinds of creatures that one presumed to live elsewhere. And then there was this sort of metaphysical, spiritual monsters of the medieval period. But today we have these moral monsters, people like Jeffrey Dahmer, serial killers. And, the mind reels at this stuff because it's so far off the moral map of what we understand to motivate human action. And so we use this term monster, I think, still in an intelligent way to sort of demarcate these people who are off this map. And I think that's a sort of we see that as a continuing thread from the ancient world all the way to the present.
You had talked about the ideas that that monsters can be created in the womb, like if a pregnant woman had a traumatic experience, that could be passed on. And I think I remember when I watched the Elephant Man, I don't remember if it was actually in the fictionalized version or if it was in like one of the documentaries that the Barkers were saying that the mom had been frightened by an elephant and that had passed on the elephantine features to John Merrick. And I was thinking about a lot of that perception of how monsters were formed in the womb has changed since Darwin. And you actually touched on that. Would you like to talk a little bit about how Darwin changed the perception of monstrous births?
Yeah, that's an interesting sort of thread in the book that I think is not well understood. Even like when people talk about monsters, like, you know, everybody knows the sort of revolution Darwin had on all the facets of biology and even into the humanities. But what's interesting is that before he developed a natural selection as the mechanism, he actually entertained the idea of monstrous births as the kind of launching pad for new species. And this was sort of, I think this was suggested to him by Richard Owen, who was a friend of his back in the 40s. They had a falling out afterwards because Owen couldn't really accept the notions of evolution that Darwin eventually came to. But in those early days, it was Darwin's actually, when he got back from Galapagos and he had this collection, he went to Owen, and Owen was great at describing specimens and categorizing them, and so he helped Darwin go through some of the actual specimens that he had brought back from the Beagle. And it was during this time that they spent time in the Hunterian Museum, which Owen was the curator of. And the Hunterian Museum is John Hunter's museum. It goes back to sort of the previous generation. But it was filled with these sort of monstrous specimens. And so what we know from the notebooks of Darwin from the, you know, from the 1830s and 40s, the M&M notebooks in particular, he's basically trying to work out the theory before he's read Thomas Malthus and he knows about, develops natural selection. He says, well, maybe it's the case that, you know, these monsters are the starting place for new species. And then he goes through and he considers this and then he gives arguments against it. And eventually he throws this out and he says, no, it can't be this way because, you know, he interviews lots of animal breeders. And he discovers that in almost all these cases, you know, it's usually deleterious. It's usually the case that the creatures basically die off or they're sterile. They don't sort of have good reproductive potential. So he throws that over for a more gradualist notion of change, and then he hits on the natural selection theory. So this is sort of an exciting place. But one of the things that's sort of interesting for monster studies is that sort of prior to Darwin, the idea of monsters, you know, was deviation from the norm. But after Darwin, you know, he even says at one point, we're all a little bit monstrous because deviation from the norm is how nature works. That's basically variation, and all of us are deviations. So that's sort of an exciting change.
Yeah.
That's an interesting way to put that. I hadn't thought about that. Let me get back to some of the exhibits. One exhibit that I've seen a couple times, and it's actually came to my local city, is the Bodies exhibit, you know, the Plastination. Would you include the Bodies exhibit as depicting monsters? I mean, to many people, the exhibit of, you know, the insides of people, you know, the figures with where you see the muscles and skin and bones, is unnerving or distasteful or terrifying or immoral in some cases. Yet it's bizarre because, of course, that's what's inside all of us. I mean, what could be more natural than our bodies? How do you see that?
Yeah, that's a good example. I think it does have, I've seen that show. I guess it's coming in different permutations to different cities, but I've seen the version of it that came through Chicago. And, I think it does have a lot of the same features, as you hit on. There's something disgusting about it, and also intriguing and exciting, and it's possibly even more disturbing because it's not some other sort of thing, you know, it's not some bizarre creature, it's actually us, and it brings in one of the features, I think, that I talk about in the book, Freud's notion of the uncanny. I'm not really a Freudian per se, but he hit on something sort of psychologically interesting, which is this phenomenon of the uncanny. And he says, you know, it's one thing to be afraid of something. It's another thing to sort of have angst or, you know, existential dread. But there's a unique sort of psychological phenomenon when something reminds you of something familiar, but at the same time, something foreign and sort of that you're unaccustomed to. And there's this simultaneous experience that you get that's sort of unlike any other. And I think you find this in, like, those Plastination sorts of exhibits where you're, you know, this is a human being, but my God, you know, look at it. The skin's been peeled off it. It's just this sort of, it's just the meat, mm-hmm. so to speak, of the of who we are, and yet it's us. In some cases, I think the guy actually blew up the bodies and made them bigger than they normally were by sort of infusing them with more of this fluid. So there's something like familiar and incredibly unfamiliar at the same time. I know a lot of gamers have noticed this phenomenon of the uncanny too in gaming, because they talk about when you have an avatar of some kind that's really animal looking or really bizarre looking, you relate to it in one way. But as it gets closer and closer to the human form, then you get into this uncanny region where the thing, you know, like some of this bad CGI from, you know, 10 years ago, you can see it looks like humans, but not quite in the eyes. It looks it's sort of off, and it gives you this unsettling feeling. And I think there's a long tradition in the monster stories and in the monster images that plays on this uncanny psychological phenomenon.
Something from earlier in the book. I've read a lot of books about monsters, but I found a lot of new and interesting things in here. And you talked about the Malleus Maleficarum, the Hammer of Witches book, which was used during the witch hunter trials in medieval times. But I had never heard, I usually hear about its term, its contents, including, you know, how to torture witches and how to determine if someone's a witch. But what I had never heard before was you talked about how that the author, I think his name was Institoris, said that, you know, there's sort of a theological question about how could demons and devils have power if God has the motive power of the universe. And he had come up with this methodology where he says that they can't break the rules of the universe, but they have really, really detailed knowledge of how things work and how to manipulate the rules and work within those rules. And I thought, wow, you know, from a gaming perspective, that makes demons and devils and witches the ultimate rules lawyers, which just kind of amused me. But it was really, I'd never actually heard that part before. So,
yeah, I had not heard that too. And then I basically went through the text really carefully and found all kinds of crazy stuff in there. So that was a very interesting example of it.
How long did it take you to write this book? It's very detailed and covers a hell of a lot of ground.
It took a few years. I sort of hatched the idea. Let me see. Now, it came out about a year ago, less than a year ago. and it was in production for a while, so I have to sort of work backwards. But I would say I developed the idea over the course of a year, and then it took me about 3 years to write it, because as you can see, it's pretty heavily researched. I've written several books. Like, this is my sixth book, and this thing has a huge amount of notes in the back, end notes, based on the research I did, so that readers can, if they're interested, or you know, their interest gets piqued in a certain area, they can go to this stuff and follow up. So it's heavily annotated. So that always takes a little longer. You want to get everything just right.
And that's also one of the reasons that it is such a good book. Because again, you know, Blake and I, we write the stuff, we live it, we read it, and we've seen lots and lots of books that are on monsters, or, you know, of some, you know, whether it's Bigfoot or Chupacabra or whatever else. And the vast majority of them, certainly, you know, I would guess 90% of them are, number one, non-skeptical. Number two, it's clear that the writers haven't done a lick of research. There's little or no references, no end notes. It's just sort of, you know, something they copied off Wikipedia and from another previous authors. And so it's nice to see someone writing in a scholarly way about these things. So
the book has been very well received. I think it's gotten excellent reviews, and it's been heavily reviewed. But what's funny is, like, when I see somebody like who writes, they don't like it, it's usually somebody who's picked it up and they just want, you know, like crazy stories of stuff, you know, from this really gullible tradition that you're talking about, which is definitely the dominant tradition on monsters. There's another, maybe there's one other sort of academic and more scholarly approach to monsters, but it's heavily influenced by sort of postmodern deconstruction literary theory. And that stuff is also, I had to plow through a lot of that stuff too in order to write, you know, an informed book, but that stuff is pretty tedious.
First of all, we'll have a link to your book in our show notes so that people can buy a copy if they want to. Early in the book, you talk about an instance when Alexander the Great came up on a castle and had to do battle with a bunch of monsters. And this was kind of it seems like a very, you know, almost mythological tale about Alexander in India. But at the same time, those kind of stories were coming out of the Middle East and into Europe and being accepted as true, right? Later on, you know, we get stories like Frankenstein and Dracula, which are clearly fiction, but draw on that tradition of monster lore. Where do you think that sort of breakdown happens? I mean, where is it that people start to become a little bit more skeptical about monsters and not necessarily treating them as real? In history, where does that happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, the way this is ordinarily sort of cashed out is that, you know, you basically have the dark ages of the medieval period, the rebirth of ancient Greek rationalism in the Renaissance, and then quickly after you get the scientific revolution, and, you know, the sort of skeptical method gets, you know, and the empirical method gets underway and sort of clears house from a lot of superstition. And it when I did this research, so I found that it was way more complicated than that. And the skeptical moments really come and go. They really vacillate with gullibility. So you look at these periods, even in the ancient Greek world, I describe, you know, the attitudes towards hermaphrodites, or because there were some very crazy supernatural sort of beliefs about hermaphrodites. And even in Roman law, it was thought that if you found one, you'd better drown it right away, because it was a sign of, you know, it was an omen of really bad stuff, and you got to get it out of the, you know, out of the city. And then rationalists would come in and hold the day for maybe a couple of centuries even, and then it would swing back again. And so you see, for example, even in Aristotle's day, if we go back even further, Aristotle was incredibly skeptical and a rationalist about the sciences and about nature, but he couldn't help, you know, the world was a bigger place then, and so stories coming in of creatures, if they seemed, you know, like they were corroborated a couple of times by travelers, well, it seemed like it was something that, that could be out there. And so the story of skepticism, you know, is complicated, and it's not this sort of crescendo, slow crescendo. I refer to this case in the book about, you know, cryptozoology. I mean, I think there's a lot of crazy stuff in cryptozoology. I also think, you know, if you go back in history to even like Thomas Jefferson, who was very interested in the natural world and considered himself a kind of scientist, you can see where the world was a much bigger place then. When he sent Lewis and Clark west, he actually said, hey, keep your eye out for some of this amazing stuff that could be out there alive. And he's referring to the fossil finds. You know, the fossil finds that are coming out of the Paris Basin are just these giant creatures, and then the Megatheria. He himself was sort of instrumental in discovering and describing the Great Claw, which turned out to be a giant sloth. And he thought this stuff must be alive out there somewhere because nature is really big and unexplored. And so you got to give it to him that he... You know, it sounds to us gullible from our point of view, but from his point of view, it was a fairly reasonable thing to think. So that dynamic is fairly interesting over history.
In your book, you depict many monsters as evil and bad. In fact, that's sort of one of the, you know, the unnatural history of our worst fears. But in fact, many monsters such as Bigfoot and lake monsters like Nessie and Champ are seen by many people, especially people who see, who eyewitnesses and people who support them and believe in them, as benign, wisdom-bearing creatures connected to nature. In many cases, you know, if you ask people what is Champ-like or Ogopogo-like, it's considered this sort of cute, fluffy. You know, they have dolls depicting them, and you go to Loch Ness, and they have plush animals. So these are not scary, terrifying, evil, bad creatures. How does that fit into your thesis?
Yeah, that's a good point, and I've lived in China for a while, and I lived in Cambodia for a while, and I have a long-standing interest in East Asian culture, Japanese animism, some of the stuff coming. You know, you think about the dragon in China, which is so beloved that people even refer to themselves as the children of the dragon. And I think it's often the case that. And my book, because it focuses on the West, tends to trace this. It's often the case that monsters are these horrible, you know, creatures that instill fear and represent, you know, our vulnerabilities. But there is, as you were suggesting, this whole other tradition of the monstrous, which is just the what I would call creatures of wonder. They defy the categories and our ordinary classifications for things, and they simply appeal to us as curious, you know, as curious beings. Like we are, I think, epistemologically driven to know and to try to answer mysteries. And so some creatures come along and they sort of embody some of this mystery and wonder, and that's something that I think you can see in some of these other creatures. And then we sort of also humanize them, you know, we put this sort of Disney spin on it, and we have, you know, Monsters, Inc. and Monsters versus Aliens, and they're sort of cute and cuddly, and some of this is, I think, also designed to, you know, just humanize and make some of this mystery, you know, less disturbing, something more palatable.
Well, that's interesting. So you think that people have this natural desire for something wondrous. Mm-hmm. Would you call that a wanderlust?
yeah, I suppose so. It sounds kind of lame, but yeah.
That might account for things like the Minnesota Iceman and the Georgia Bigfoot and the Cardiff Giant, those kind of phenomena. Is that what do you think that's tapping into?
I think so. I mean, there's something, you know, even as a skeptic, I think, in fact, skeptics are incredibly curious. They're the most curious people, and they're oftentimes driven by stuff they can't understand. and then they're drawn to it to try to understand it. And frequently, you know, you can. And one of the, of course, the my own view is that the best way to understand the mysteries of nature is through science. But everybody, you know, all of the great science popularizers, Carl Sagan, Stephen Jay Gould, you know, they all recognize that wonder has a great role to play even in the scientific quest. So in many ways, I see, you know, some of this fascination with with exotic creatures as just a continuation of this sort of human urge to understand things.
Let me go back to what you're saying about the sort of delineation between some monsters being evil and some monsters sort of being embraced as sort of warm, cuddly creatures. I'm not sure I understand the distinction you're making, because I mean there are certainly magical creatures that are folkloric or mythological, such as, you know, elves, fairies, Pegasus, things like that. They're certainly fantastical. They're not real. But that are, you know, are they monsters? I mean, is a fairy or an elf a monster? I mean, in a way it is, but you know, you don't hear evil fairies for the most part. So,
right.
Just because it's a, you know, so I guess what I'm saying is that those sorts of creatures, I think, fulfill that role of being something that's out there that is benign. But yet there's these other monsters that aren't.
Yeah, I would the way I'm thinking of it is almost like fantastical creatures would be almost like a genus, and monsters would be a sort of species within that genus. But there would be these other creatures as well, which would be benign or, you know, neutral or just sort of low-grade mischievous, because low-grade mischievous spirits really are the main populators of the animistic traditions around the world, mm-hmm. whether it be Japanese or, as I said before, I lived in Southeast Asia. In Southeast Asia, there's a very strong belief in animistic spirits, which are like ghosts, and they're tutelary spirits. They sort of are housed in specific regions. Like this tree has a spirit, this river has a spirit, and their position is that you've got to build these spirit houses, and you create little houses for these animistic spirits to live in. And you give sort of shot glasses of whiskey and, you know, lotus flowers and various offerings to keep the spirits placated. So if you can basically have a relationship with them that's totally peaceful. You know, you're basically both living in the same yard, mm-hmm. and it's okay because you've given them the right kind of offerings. But if you don't give them the right offerings, well, they'll turn on you very, very quickly. And so I remember my friend, when I was in Laos, my friend who's Laotian said, you know, when the full moon comes, he always puts whiskey out for the spirits, because if he doesn't, they will trouble his children's dreams and bring nightmares to his kids. So a lot of these creatures are really, I think, you know, they can be benign, and you can have a warm and fuzzy relationship with them. But if you don't treat them right, they'll turn on you. And so that's the sort of, I guess, you know, that's the sort of domain of beings that we're talking about. Some of the more nefarious ones I sort of bracket out and say, you know, these are just evil creatures and they have a tradition, a monster tradition. Some of them I think are sort of on the fence and go both ways.
It's interesting that you bring up the whole idea of sort of leaving sacrifices for monsters, because I found that in some of my research, particularly the lake monster Ogopogo in British Columbia. There was a tradition where the native Native Americans there, Indians, the First Nations groups would actually, when they were crossing this one part of the lake, they would sometimes make sacrifices. They would kill a dog, or they would leave food or something, and they would drop it into the water to allow safe passage. And it sounds like very much in that same tradition.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wasn't aware of that tradition, but you can see how that goes all the way back. The idea that we're living in a world that's populated by some creatures that we can't sort of negotiate with normally, you know, with speech and so forth. and that these are powerful, you can see that whole tradition of devotion and ritual is sort of designed to appease them. And so that brings an interesting question about the relationship between the gods and the monsters.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah. How do you delineate between gods and monsters if they all require
sacrifice?
Yeah,
I mean, it's a good point. I mean, in the early days, it really was in the polytheistic days, you had really two sides. You had the good and the bad. You had the gods on the good side, generally speaking, although they weren't all good. They were quite... they were morally repugnant too, but then you had the monsters, and I guess what happens in the West is that slowly polytheism evolves into monotheism, and so you build in, okay, your God can do this and your God can do that, but hey, my God, Yahweh, he can do all that stuff, and slowly you start building up a monotheistic God that has all of the powers that were distributed over the polytheistic gods. And then you have this whole new problem, which is that this problem of evil. And in the book, I talk about the problem of monsters, which is before you had the monotheistic God who's all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good, you could sort of explain evil and monsters. But afterwards, you've got this additional problem, which is, why does God let monsters exist? Why does he let demons torture people? And what's the point of this? Because he clearly knows about it. He knows everything. He's clearly powerful enough to stop it. He's all-powerful. And he's supposed to be all-good, so why does he let this happen? So monsters become this new theological problem once you get monotheism going. And so I try to trace how that gets worked out in the book.
Another thing you talk about, or I think you give a lot of power to, is the role of Frankenstein in the change of how monsters are portrayed in Western culture. How important was Frankenstein as far as changing the cultural perception of monsters?
Yeah, I think Shelley's book, it's interesting that it, in its original formulation, it didn't have quite the same kind of critique of the sciences that I think the later versions have. And, in the later versions, it's oftentimes taken to be a kind of romantic criticism of, hey, the sciences are great, but look what can happen when you unleash their power. You can basically end up playing God, and isn't this awful? And so it was oftentimes interpreted this way, I think. The story, of course, I think goes back to even earlier traditions. Like I mentioned, the Jewish tradition of the golem. Here you have a giant that the rabbi in Prague creates in order to protect the Jewish ghettos in Prague against pogroms and aggressors. But the giant basically can't quite be controlled. So when you wind up something this powerful, do you have control over it? And I think that message, both you can see it in the Golem story and you can see it in the Frankenstein story, has, I think, stayed with us because of the incredible advances of science and technology. I mean, the fact that we today can now get into the genome and do manipulations that hitherto were unimaginable has kept this Frankenstein fear alive and well. This sort of, are we playing God? Are we messing with nature in a way that's going to come back in unforeseen consequences? And so I think in a way, Frankenstein just crystallizes all of those anxieties about human knowledge and science. And you see it, it comes up again. You'll just see somebody will talk about stem cell research, and then somebody perhaps on the religious side of things will scream Frankenstein syndrome or something. And so I think it has shaped the way we think about science today.
In your book, you cover a lot of the history of it, and of course that's one of the benefits is understanding the history of it, so you can understand the present context to it. But what's your take on the modern monster search? What's your take on the people who go out there, the groups that are out there looking for Bigfoot and chupacabras and Nessie and stuff? Do you think that that's all a fool's errand, or do you think there's merit to it, or what do you think about that?
It's That's a good question. You sort of have to, it's almost hard to describe this kind of search, you know, in the right way, because as soon as you start sort of using terms like Bigfoot, I think the skeptic in me wants to go, whoa, okay, you know, this is a lot more wishful thinking and so forth. But if we sort of, let's say we neutralize this kind of a search from these sort of really loaded terms like Bigfoot and Chupacabra, and we instead ask ourselves, are there populations of creatures that could be big enough to be breeding and reproducing, and could they in fact have hitherto been undiscovered, and are they perhaps in some very dense wooded regions, or are they in some areas where human beings just haven't made you know, much of a entry into? There, I think, you know, totally, I'm all thumbs up. You know, it seems to me that it would be unscientific to rule out that kind of pursuit sort of beforehand. It's an empirical question. So, and the fact that, as I said, we keep finding stuff in the oceans, that's where I think the really crazy stuff is going to continue to be found, is an indicator that, yeah, we don't have a good handle on all of the fauna, you know, that the planet has. And so I think we are going to continue to be surprised. It just so happens that some of the people who go looking for this stuff tend to be kooky and tend to give this kind of search a bad name. But that's, you know, that's just my personal view.
One of the other things you talk about in the book is about racism and xenophobia and in their role in monsterizing or demonizing sort of what people call the other, right? So how do you think the psychological construct of a monster affects human interaction when we can do this to our opponents, where we can turn them into demons or monsters?
Yeah, it's clearly this demonization goes way back. You see that whenever cultures meet each other, if they're unfamiliar with each other, they tend to project, you know, in the old days it was this sort of notion of being a barbarian or being uncultured or uncivilized. And so you frequently had the ancient Greeks and Romans talking about monsters living sort of in India, and even their understanding of Indian people, for example, was that they just had all kinds of lore and crazy stuff about them. And this is clearly something we still do when we have enemies. We try to dehumanize them as much as possible. I make this analogy in the book. You know, we had this film 300 where we had the you know, the Spartans fighting the Persian army, and I think a lot of people are familiar with this Hollywood film. And some people pointed out, you know, that is it accidental? I happen to like the film just because it was a great sort of testosterone-fueled adventure story, and I enjoyed it as a Hollywood film. But a lot of people pointed out, well, look at how the Persians are represented. And in the film, you don't see them as men, you see them as monsters. They're actually sort of, you know, they use the, you know, special effects technology to sort of show them as actually sort of half animal, and, you know, they've got fangs and the whole bit. And of course, they obviously weren't any of this. But as I think some Persian scholars pointed out, they were like, well, you know, is it any accident that we're also sort of in a war with Iraq, which is where, of course, ancient Persians are from. And we're sort of in this so-called clash of civilizations. And, you know, I think this is perhaps it's a subtle argument, but I think there's something to it. We all tend to demonize the enemy. And one of the functions that this plays is it allows us to fight them. And I think the average soldier doesn't think of his enemy as much of a human being as something more inhuman. And I think there's a lot of psychological training to get that done. So that's one of the functions of monsters that I think is still with us. You basically want to dehumanize the enemy in order to eliminate them.
So were there any monsters that you wanted to include in your book but didn't have time or space for?
There wasn't any one particular monster that got cut out. I managed to keep everything in that I wanted to. I regret that I wasn't able to discuss, you know, the vampires and zombies as much as I should have, because they in the last couple of years they've really taken off as a cultural meme, and they're sort of everywhere.
Yeah, they've really resurrected.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I wish I would have had more on that than I think people, you know, why is it, I guess. I would have loved to sort of muse more on why it is that those are so fascinating for people.
Okay. Well, let me wrap up with a question that we ask all our guests, which is, what is your favorite monster?
What is my favorite monster? God, you know, this is, I got to say, I don't know why, but it's got to be the Wolfman. And I think it's strictly because when I was a kid, it was my first big exposure. My dad and I would watch Creature Features, and they had the Lon Chaney Jr. version of the Wolfman. And I got to say, it just got into my spine. And for whatever reason, like, it continues to be a great monster for me, the Wolfman.
It's a classic. Mm-hmm. I just watched it with my daughters the other day. I'm trying to introduce them to the old black and white movies. And they call them gray. I never really thought about it. They're not really black and white. They call them gray. They're gray movies. So, but I actually let them watch the Hammer version, but I had to kind of edit it a little bit. It was a little bit too bloody.
Those are bloody.
They're quite bloody, but they loved the monster itself, but the Lon Chaney is just a classic. It's a classic.
I never could quite get. I never got excited about the vampires for some reason, the Dracula and so forth. I liked the more animalistic creatures for some reason.
Yeah, you know, I in the vampire movies I've enjoyed, I think I like the ones where the vampire is more of a monster and less human. You know, where maybe they're tragic in the sense that they can't control their hunger. I thought Stephen King's Salem's Lot, the vampire there, he's bad, but he also, you know, he seems to have some touch in his humanity, but he's also has an insatiable hunger. Well, anyway, it's cool. I like it when the vampire is really a monster, because frankly, if you make it too human, it's just a human, right? I mean, you know,
that's right.
So he's just a superpowered human, and that's not really a monster, is it? There's got to be something frightening. So anyway, thank you so much for your time, and this was such an excellent book.
Yeah, it was great talking to you.
I appreciate you guys having me on. It was really is a really good interview. I enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot. Look for it. Oh, well, yeah. What's coming up next? You working on anything else?
I'm working on a book now for University of Chicago. A very different kind of book. It's a critique of, we have this tension between our desire to be fair to everybody, and also we have these sort of natural family nepotistic desires. And I'm trying to sort of do a philosophy book that looks at this tension. So very different.
We'll bring you back for our other podcast, Family Talk.
That'd be great.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. Today we interviewed author Stephen Asma on his new book, On Monsters. A link to his book will be in the show notes at monstertalk.org. Monster Talk is produced with the help of Skeptic Magazine. Your hosts are myself, Blake Smith, Ben Radford, managing editor of Skeptical Inquirer magazine, and Dr. Karen Stolzno, skeptical investigator and blogger. If you enjoy Monster Talk, please give us a review at iTunes. If you hate Monster Talk, be sure and visit our forums at www.skepticforum.com, where you can tell us how to make the show better. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily the views of Skeptic Society or Skeptic Magazine. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
for more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
But I wanted to talk about, you talk early in the story, it's not a story, let me read it.